This is a production of the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network. Welcome to Road School Moms Radio, where education meets adventure. Your hosts, Kimberly Travaglino of Full Time Families and Mary Beth Goff, the road trip teacher, will share advice, information, and encouragement to bring your road schooling efforts to new levels.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Road School Moms Live. I'm one of your co-hosts, Kimberly Travaglino, co-founder of Full Time Families and Road Schooling Mom to Four Kiddos, and I'm coming to you live tonight in beautiful, sunny Las Vegas, which is the site of the second of two rallies going to be taking place 10 days from now in by Lake Mead. So welcome, and I believe on the show with me tonight is, as always, my lovely co-host.
Mary Beth Goff, your road trip teacher, also a traveling homeschooling mama to four kiddos on the road, and I'm the author and creator of RoadTripTeacher.com, and I chronicle our travels over at DiaryOfARoadMom.com, and we are so excited to be with you this beautiful Sunday night from wherever in the world you are. I'm coming to you live from Southwest Florida, one of my favorite places in the country, and so glad to be here. How are you, Kimberly?
I'm great, Mary Beth. I had a really great road school week that I can't wait to tell the listeners about. And how about you? How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. We had an unexpected week at our rig. My dad actually showed up on Tuesday a little bit unexpectedly and actually stayed for the whole week, which you know my dad pretty well. And you know that he usually comes in and out usually in a day, and this time he stayed for several days, and we've had just a great big unexpected week of family and visiting, and it's kind of changed our road school up a little bit. We didn't get to do some of the things that we were really psyched up to do, so we've put those off until next week, but we still got some fun things done. My kiddos participated in a Pinewood Derby, which was also we just had a week of unexpected pleasures. That's all I know how to say.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm happy to hear that. This week, last week, we talked about that we were going to change up our road schools considerably this week, and you inspired me to take on the No School, No Screens challenge, in which we suspend school for a week. We could do that because we go through school year-round, so it's no big deal for them to have a week off. And we suspend all electronics for a week. And I'm happy to report that it was a very successful week. I can't say 100% that the kids didn't learn anything. I think they learned tons of stuff. But I can say 100% they did not occupy themselves with screen time, and that was such a pleasure. As you know, we were dry camping last week in Lake Havasu. It was fantastic. We had a killer spot in this beautiful desert oasis, and it was really nice to be unplugged all week long. I didn't get to be unplugged all week long, but I did make an effort to be more unplugged than I normally am. But the kids were unplugged all week long, and I got to see them play and use their imagination and create games and enjoy each other and themselves, and it was really great. How did your week go?
It went well. We also have kind of stuck to our no screens rule. We had a couple of days that we, because my dad was here, we'd done some things a little bit differently. But I can tell you, because my dad's a reader anyway, that's where I get my love of reading, I guess, because I always seen him with the book in his hand from the time I was little. So he spent a lot of time with the kids reading this week. So that was kind of a nice addition to our road school. But we kind of stuck with the no screens thing, too. And I don't know, I mean, I guess you've alluded to that in what you said, but it just, it makes my heart warm and fuzzy when I see how much better they interact with each other and how much better they play with each other and, you know, how more engaged they are with, you know, their imagination when they are not, you know, when they haven't had that screen time. And it's not even, for me, I think that it's not just the screen time when they're actually on there, but I think that after they've been on a screen for a while, you know, those few hours after, I mean, it's almost like you have to, like, I don't know, deprogram them a little bit. And once you're finally over that hump, then it's all good.
Yeah, I know. You know, we've talked about this, and the fact that one of mine will be on screens all day long if I let him. All day, all night, he wouldn't eat, he wouldn't sleep. He'd just play on screens all day long. And that really is troublesome to me. And so it's important to for me to see that he still has that spark of creativity and doesn't take that much to dust it off. And we will be making a new screen plan as a result of our observations this week and see where that gets us. There's always a constant ebb and flow. You know, a lot of people will come up to me and go, you're on Road School Moms, right? Yeah, that's us. Well, how do you road school? Like, how can you tell me right now how to road school? And, you know, Meredith and I can say it a million times, there's no one solution. And even when we find things that work, it doesn't mean that it's going to be something we can stick with forever. You know, things work for a while, and then they don't work, and they lose their luster, and we have to come up with new ideas. So this whole process is just that. It's a process. You find that, too?
I do. I find that. It was a very true statement. And one thing I can tell you that for months, years, well, the whole time we've been on the road, and this kind of trickles down from when we were in our sticks and bricks, that my kids have always went to sleep with the TV on in some form or fashion. And when we got in our rig, you know, everyone was basically, you know, everybody sleeps in the same vicinity. And so there was always, you know, discussion. It seemed like it was always like a family movie or everybody was watching the same thing at night. And then, you know, they would trickle off and go to sleep. And one of the changes that we made actually last week, before you and I even talked on the show last week, was that we were going to go to, you know, no screens before bed. And what we've kind of done is, you know, the screens all go off, all screens of any type, about an hour and a half before bedtime. And that's also been a great, it's been a good thing, it's been a really good thing.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, now, one of the, I don't want to say downside because that's too strong a word, but one of the considerations that we had to take into account when we didn't have screens for them to use was them playing outside. And as I mentioned before, I was camped next to Road School Mom Clementine and having a lovely time with her and her family. And we were straightening up on Tuesday night, and along came this ginormous scorpion. I mean, just absolutely the size of your hand, Mary Beth, from the nail of your middle finger to your wrist. That's how big this scorpion was. And I thought, oh, boy, everyone get in. Get on the computers. It's safer that way. And so from that episode, this show was really born out of that episode because Clementine was a little nervous, as was I, about the wildlife in this area that we were in. It's super rustic. You know, there's no hookups there. That's what dry camping is. It's being completely self-contained. And there were rattlesnakes in the area, although we never saw any, and scorpions, and a whole host of inhospitable animals. And so we got to talking, and she said, I'd really love to listen to an expert tell us what it is we should do if we run across these episodes, or if, you know, God forbid, our children get bit or stung, what is it we should do? And, you know, you and I love to have these shows where we say, don't be scared, be prepared. That's a Mary Beth-ism. And so here we are tonight, and we're going to be in a few minutes interviewing Gregory Davenport. He's a wilderness survival expert and a wilderness medicine expert, which I assume means that he can figure out how to find medicine in the wilderness, but I'm sure he'll tell us that himself when he's on. So I'm really excited about it. Do you ever go hiking? Do you ever enjoy the great outdoors in a more rustic, maybe sometimes scary way?
We do. Although I'll say I'm usually pretty aware of those kinds of things. That's just something I can be pretty much of a scaredy cat. You already know that about me. So that's something that I usually have a kind of, and I remember going, when we went to Tucson last year before our first big road school convention, I can remember having a talk with the kids about, you know, you can't go out in flip-flops and, you know, snakes hide under, you know, rattlesnakes and poisonous snakes and whatever, you know, that's something that's very prevalent out in that area, and you needed to have on, you know, preferably their cowboy boots or, you know, some kind of closed-toed shoes and when we were hiking and that kind of thing. So I'm pretty aware of that. And I think that no matter where you're at in the country, if you travel, I mean, you have to be aware that, you know, there's, you know, like, you know, if you're in Florida, if you're in Southwest Florida, especially down here in Everglades area, you should probably be pretty aware of alligators and where they hang out. And you're probably going to encounter snakes of some type. There are not very many poisonous ones, I don't think, in our area, but there are, you know, all kinds of different kinds of snakes. And I don't know. I just think you have to be aware of your surroundings no matter where you're at and be prepared. Like you said, be prepared. Don't be scared. And, you know, just kind of always have that backup information in your back of your mind so that you know what to do if a problem arises.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things I'm curious tonight to talk about is specifically when you're going on hikes, because it's not much for us to think about going on like a one-mile hike. That's pretty much what we as a crew can handle up in here. So, but 1 mile hiking can mean that we've actually parked the truck in a quite remote area, and then we're 1 mile into the wilderness. And what happens if we're at the end of our 1 mile hike, as far away from the truck as possible? What do we do then if we need to get out of that situation? I don't want to be scared, like you mentioned. I just want to be totally informed about, you know, what is the smart thing to do in these situations?
Well, you know, the thing of that is, too, when you start out on a walk or a hike or, you know, whatever kind of outdoor activity, you know, 9 times out of 10, you get farther away. You know, you go farther, you have to be really cognizant of how far you're going because, you know, whenever you get to that point, you have to go back. And that's one
yes.
thing that I, you know what I mean? And, like, especially we've got your kids and they're so excited and everybody's, you know, flying along and you're rushing to catch up and keep up with each other. And, you know, at some point you're like, whoa, whoa, we better, you know, make it a trip back. So that's, you know, something to definitely be aware of and a really good point.
You know, it reminds me of summer 2013. Yeah, I believe that's it, when Chris and I went on our big ATVing date, and we took the ATVs up a mountain in Colorado and unloaded them up there and then went on this trail. And we had no intention of ever turning around until we were tired. We packed a picnic, and we were just going. And I can recall in the first half of that episode thinking, why does anybody hike? This is so much faster and so much more fun. I'm never going to walk again. This is for the birds. I'm going to get everyone an ATV, and off we go. And then, as you know, I turned around, and I started experiencing some ATV issues, namely of the steering variety, and I decided to steer myself right off the side of the mountain. It turns out at that particular place, you know, because we had a guardian angel with us, I have no doubt, we had cell phone signal. But I do remember thinking, wow, I told our family we were going to one particular location, and then we, you know, just changed our mind in the middle of driving the truck. We just changed our mind and said, hey, let's not go to that place. Let's go to this place. And so no one knew where we were. We didn't know how to get emergency services. And ultimately, it obviously all worked out, and an ambulance was able to meet us at the bottom of the mountain, and because I had broken my wrist and I couldn't drive the ATV out. But those situations really remind you, at a minimum, when you're in that type of situation, you definitely want to find that log. If you've ever gone hiking, you'll know that on some paths there's a log that you want to sign into, because there are rangers who monitor that log, and if you don't sign back out, then they, you know, that's a big clue to look for you. And you also definitely want to make sure that, you know, you've told your loved ones, you've told your immediate people where it is you're going to be, and you actually show up at that spot. But I see that Gregory Davenport has joined us, so I'm going to bring him on. Thank you so much for being part of the show.
Sure, great to be here.
Gregory, I found you through a really quick Google search looking for wilderness expert, and you popped up as the first link, and I'm just so excited that you were available to come and talk to our moms about wilderness and outdoor safety. As you know, our listeners are a bunch of adventurous families, and we're in all different stages of wilderness survival awareness. So it's really great to have this show to point to when new families come online and want to go exploring.
Well, I think parenting is an adventure in survival all in its own right, if you ask me. But, yeah, survival is a great thing. I mean, I have kids. I love my kids. I actually have two sets of twins, age 7 and 5. And, you know, the adventure that I have with them is amazing. I strongly advocate that people, you know, take their kids out into the wilderness and teach them to enjoy the outdoors and not be afraid of it, but to experience what Mother Nature can provide. It's a great opportunity.
Can you give us a little bit about background about yourself and how it is you became a wilderness expert?
Well, my wilderness background began in the military. I was a SEER, which stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape expert in the military. Basically what that means is I trained air crew members how to survive in both combat and non-combat scenarios in every global and climatic condition of the world with extremely limited resources. When I left the military, I went on and since then have written a few books and have ran my own programs and done quite a bit of public speaking and platform presentations related to my concepts on wilderness survival. I also work in medicine. I went to school at the University of Washington and became a PA or a physician assistant and actually went on to get my doctorate and work in the health sciences arena in the education world. But I think the greatest thing that I attribute my expertise to is the fact that I have children, and they are the catalyst that allows me to expand my desire to explore and understand nature and to stay safe while I do it.
That's so interesting, with your background. Can you tell me, because, you know, obviously the majority of us have one, if not more, kiddos that we always have with us. Is there an age limit, in your opinion, to wilderness adventures?
No, there really isn't. I don't believe there's an age limit. I believe that the whole concept of introducing your kids to the outdoors depends on when you're ready. It's more about when you're ready than when the child is, because, you know, for us, we just purchased some nice backpacks that we could put our kids in or a swath that we could put our child in, and we were introducing them to the trails before they could even talk. Now, we changed our adventure. We were on trails that were more level terrain, had less risk involved in them, but yet they were being exposed to it at the same time that they were learning to crawl and walk and so on. But, you know, not everybody wants to do that. So it's kind of like swimming. You watch a child who's introduced to swimming when they're very young, you know, an infant, and, gosh, they have no fear. But if you wait until a child's, you know, starting to develop fears and so on, it's much more difficult to get them into the great outdoors. You have to be more slow and gradual on it. You can still do it. It just takes a little bit more time. But, you know, I do it as soon as possible. It's just a matter of the extreme nature of it. So how would I recommend most people do it, you know, with older kids, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, start in your backyard, then go to KOA campgrounds, and then go to, you know, some more remote campgrounds, and then eventually get off trail. But, you know, so you're slowly indoctrinating them to the outdoors and to the concept of enjoying nature.
Okay. Gregory, let's say a family is planning to take a hike, and they're putting together, you know, their beef jerky and their cheese bits and whatever. What else do you think should be in their must-pack list so that they can stay safe on the hike?
I know. It's always so interesting. You know, everybody always talks about food. And, you know, survival is all about what am I going to eat next? And, you know, the reality is we can live a long time without food. You know, we can't live very long if we become, if we have problems with exposure, where extreme heat or extreme cold, or we go without water for any great periods of time. You know, so I kind of look at survival, especially for kids. I expand it into adults, but for kids, I look at survival from a very simple concept, and that is, when I pack my pack for my child, I look at four basic things, and that's clothing, shelter, signaling, and water. And expand on that just a little bit. So what do? I usually carry something like it doesn't have to be a camelback, but I think everybody's kind of familiar with that. A small backpack that has a water bladder in it, that has a hose that can come around that you can easily drink off of. So there's your water. And then a 4 mil large garbage bag, a 4 millimeter thick large garbage bag is great. But you've got, and what this is for is to help avoid exposure injuries. So a child can put this, now you got to teach them how to do this before you go, but they can put it over their head, and by doing that, it traps dead air close to the inner side of the plastic bag in their body, keeps them warmer, protects them from wind and moisture. But you got to make sure you put a face hole there, and you show them how to put the bag on so they don't asphyxiate or in a garbage bag. I mean, so water, a little backpack, 4 mil garbage bag, a big one, a whistle, teach them how to blow it in a series of three or just to blow it, period. Also, use common sense. If you're teaching a child how to pack his pack and how to take care of himself, and you say, I want you, if you get lost, to sit down, stay put, blow that whistle. Well, son, daughter, if you lose that whistle, God forbid you lose it. I hope you don't. If you do lose it, make a noise. Grab a big stick and hit a tree three times. If we're looking for you and we hear something abnormal like that, we're going to come looking over there. So what have I said? Camelback, water, 4 mil garbage bag, a whistle, some type of headlamp, and give them some type of candy bar or something, you know. I mean, you know, they're kids. If they're lost, give them something they like. So those are the high items. Much more than that, the kids don't need to carry much more than that. The parents should be carrying the rest of the gear. You know, when they're 18, 19, let them carry your gear. But when they're 5, 6, 7, they should be carrying things that take care of that clothing, shelter, you know, water, and signaling.
Speaking of water, is there a certain amount of water that you should take for each person in your family on a trip outdoors?
Yeah, that's so debated, you know. It is so debated. The you know, the bottom line is, and for adults, an adult woman needs probably about 2.7 liters a day minimum, and an adult male probably about 3 liters a day. And that's just for an average day of normal activity. You know, if it's a hot day or even a cold day, you could need upwards of 4 to 6. But a child, at least 1, maybe 2 liters is what I would have them carry. But, you know, it's hugely debated. The problem is, it's not that if you go in and come out that 1 liter is going to be enough. It's what if you go in and get stuck, you know, what's going to be enough. So you also need to take some means of purifying your water, you know, whether it be a filter or iodine or chlorine. Even though the, you know, we see some problems with iodine and chlorine nowadays, they're still a valuable tool.
Absolutely. Now, what you just told us, do these things change if your family is hiking in the Southwest versus the Northeast?
No. You know, and it's interesting. I've seen more dehydration in the Arctic, you know, up in the northern slope of Alaska than I have in the desert. It doesn't change. What changes is what you might be exposed to. You know, let's say I'm hiking up by Seattle. I'm not going to see no copperheads there or water moccasins, you know. I'm not going to see a brown recluse, you know. But if I'm in, you know, if I'm in North Carolina or something, I might run into a copperhead or something like that. But as far as personal protection, you know, I still have to protect myself from the hot and the cold and the wind and the rain. I still have to make sure I have enough water to stay hydrated. I still have to make sure I can take care of environmental or traumatic injuries, and I need to be able to signal and have some concept of how to travel. So your needs don't change. It doesn't matter where you are. Your needs don't change. It's just how you might, the order you might meet them in, or how you might improvise to make it happen if you don't have what you should have had available to you.
So, Greg, in the event of an emergency, what are the first steps that, you know, aside from the fact that you have to remain calm, what are the first steps that you should do in case of an emergency?
Well, you know, I have two concepts on this, and we're talking about kids, so I'm going to keep it on that level right now. You know, the first step, well, regardless whether you're a kid or an adult, the first step is to stop and recognize the situation for what it is. And what we see more often than not is people don't stop. They look for that familiar rock or that familiar trail or some way to get out. And what happens more often than not is it moves them further and further and further out of that search pattern. People need to understand that search and rescue teams look in your last known location. That's where they start. So the more you move when you're lost, more often than not, you're delaying your rescue. So the first thing to do is stop and stay put. The second thing to do is identify and meet your survival needs. And those are simple: clothing, shelter, signaling, and water. So these are the things that keep you alive. Clothing and shelter are going to protect you from the wind and from the moisture and from both hot and cold injuries. You know, and then signaling, that's going to alert rescue to your location, and water is going to keep you hydrated, and we need to stay hydrated for sure. So, you know, so we stop, we identify our needs, and we meet our needs. And then the third step is to keep the faith. You know, we've done a lot of research over the years on survival, and one thing we found is the faith or the desire or the will to survive plays a higher role in somebody coming out of that situation alive than probably any other role that you could think of. So, you know, if we lose hope, we're more prone to perish. So you know, stop, stay put, identify your needs and meet them, and keep the faith. That's the key to survival right there. I mean, in a nutshell, that's it.
Well, that's fascinating. I really love those tips that you shared, and we're going to be sharing these in a blog post with our listeners as well, because, you know, again, the first inclination is to panic, and having these tips will really go really far for a lot of families. Now, let's say I'm in Red Rock Canyon State Park out here by Las Vegas, and I'm pretty deep into one of the trails, and my kid puts his hand where he shouldn't and gets a snake bite. What do I do?
You know that the majority of snake bites occur in males 18 to 27 years old, and the majority of them are on the hand. So what's that tell you about snake bites? It tells you got an 18 to 27 year old male trying to pick up a snake. But kids are normally bitten on the lower extremities more often than not. But the key with snake bites, you know, the real key is you got to recognize that about 25% of these snakes bites, you're talking about pit viper here, about 25% of them are going to be dry bites. And then the rest of them, you know, you're going to get envenomated. And the key with that is if you can identify the snake, if you can, and the key with this is going to be, is does it have a triangle shaped head or not? You know,
ooh.
And I don't want you to go looking for it, but if you can just see the head, is it an oval or elongated head, or is it triangular shaped? If it's triangular shaped, it's a pit viper for the most part in the area that you've mentioned. And that's going to help us in determining, but we've got other ways to help determine what type of bite it is. But for you as a parent, you've got to get these people to medical care. So try to identify what it is. You immobilize the extremity. So, you know, you can use some sticks or whatever you have available just to, you know, immobilize that so they're not bending at the knee and so on. You know, some people advocate putting the extremity below the heart, some above the heart. Both are wrong. You need to keep it at the level of the heart. If you put it below the heart, it gets a lot of edema that forms there, causes problems with circulation. You put it above the heart, it speeds the spread of the venom. So we're really advocating for putting it at the level of the heart. Loosen any clothing that's on them. Take any jewelry off that's on them because of swelling. And, you know, try to keep them from panicking. They're going to panic a little bit. Try not to let them walk. Carry them if you can to get them to the car. And then you got to get them to the hospital. I mean, the odds suggest that, you know, if it's an envenomation, which we're going to know within, you know, a couple hours just based on the progression of anything, we're going to need to give them anti-venom in the area that you're describing. And, you know, the odds are that this is going to be a process. So for you, try to identify. Don't go looking for it. Don't try to catch it. Leave it alone. But if you see it, really look at the shape of the head. Look at this color pattern if you can. Immobilize the extremity. Keep it at the level of the heart. You know, don't let them walk. Transport them. Carry them if you can. Loosen their clothing. Take off jewelry and try to keep them from panicking. And get them to emergency help as quick as you can. Antivenom is the most effective if it's given within 4 hours. It can have some effect outwards of 12 to 24 hours on the coagulation issues, but really on the local issues and tissue damage, it's a four-hour issue.
Wow, snakes. I'm not very excited about thinking about snake bites, but
they taste pretty good, but, you know, you got to know how to catch them and kill them, you know, and it's not with your hand.
Yeah. At least with our rig or our crew. Okay, so it's easy to know how to handle, like, a broken limb. Not easy, but at least you know, if you're at home or you're around the campground, if you get a broken limb, you probably just go straight to the ER. But what if you're out, you know, you are out on a hike and you're several miles, you know, from your truck or wherever. What do you do if you get a broken limb?
You walk out. Or so you got somebody carry you out. One of the two, right? You know, I mean, what are you going to do? You usually, if something's broken, you immobilize it. One joint below, one joint above. You know, if you're not having to walk, you know, or improvise crutches to get out, or some type of walking stick, or have somebody buddy walk with you or carry you, well, then you're going to lay down and you're going to elevate that, you know, above the heart to decrease the amount of swelling. You know, the biggest thing, it's going to depend on the severity of the break as far as whether somebody's going to be able to get out or not. I mean, sometimes, you know, if it's just you and one other person and they can't get out, and you know, sometimes you're going to have to leave them and you're going to have to get out and get back in with help. But, you know, if you're able to immobilize it using branches and, you know, paracord or whatever type of cloth material you have, you can create a very sturdy immobilizing process of a stick on each side of the leg, a joint below, a joint above, securing it in place, and then, you know, improvising crutches or a walking stick from any other solid branches that you might be able to find in the area. Now, of course, if you're in a rocky desert, you know, I mean, we could what if this forever. You know, somebody's going to say, well, how am I going to do that when I'm in the desert or the barren ice of the Arctic? Well, yeah, well, what if? I mean, you're not. So, you know, so improvising in any situation is about identifying what resources you have available to you and using them for their intended purpose to meet your needs. So the key to that is going to be, well, I need to immobilize this leg. If they're going to have to walk, I need to figure out how I can help support them in this walking process, and what do I have available to me to make that happen. And that's going to take some ingenuity. But, you know, people improvise all the time. I mean, people hammer in nails with a wrench, or sometimes they kill a bug with a shoe. I mean, we use things for other than their intended purpose all the time. So with a broken extremity, you may have to do the same thing.
Yeah, well, you know, as RVers, as full-time RVers, we know all about ingenuity and multiple uses. So key there, I guess, again, would be not to panic and really be able to stand back and assess the situation and get what you need to get done. Now, let's say we're going to the Smokies for the summer and we want to go hike part of the Appalachian Trail, and the weather's been really terrible and we're running out of time. How can I assess the weather to make sure that I don't get stuck out there with my family? Or what if the weather changes really fast? What should I do about weather on my survival strategies?
Well, that's all about prior proper preparation. But weather is, you know, weather can change fast. And the key with weather is how does it impact exposure? I mean, is it going to set you up? And now you're talking about exposure related to wind and moisture, either snow or rain is what it sounds like you're talking about. So, you know, in those situations, you know, hopefully you've packed correctly and, you know, you have the ability to create some type of shelter if you need to, where quickly you can create something that protects you from the wind and the moisture, and you can weather it out, or you have something that can protect you from wind and moisture and you can hike out. I mean, the bottom line is, how did you pack your gear? And you pack your gear based on those, your five survival essentials. So those are personal protection, which is clothing, shelter, fire, sustenance, which is food and water, health, which deals with psychological stress, traumatic injuries, environmental injuries, signaling, and travel. So if you packed your gear, because you're on the trail, you packed your gear to meet your needs. If the weather changes, you have appropriate clothing that you can add or take off to keep you cooler or warmer, depending upon the weather conditions, to protect you from wind and moisture, depending upon the weather conditions, or to go to ground if you need to. You know, just to, you know, to hightail it and run out is not always going to be the option. So, you know, the other thing, of course, is if you haven't packed appropriately based on those five survival essentials, then you're going to have to improvise. And, you know, improvising, again, is the key to success in life. And I know that you do and the people who follow you are well-versed in improvising because, you know, you don't have a 4,400-square-foot home full of junk, you know, and sometimes you don't have Lowe's right down the street. So you guys have to, you know, make do with what you have, and you have to use things for multiple uses. The same thing holds true here. If it's not in my backpack, what does Mother Nature provide me? If you're in the Smoky Mountains, is there a tree shelter, you know, a tree that I can get into? Can I create a shelter from the tree? Is there duff on the ground that I can create a shelter from? You know, I mean, so there's ways to meet your needs beyond what's in your backpack. But it's all about, if the weather changes quickly, how do I stay cool or warm, and how do I protect myself from the wind and the moisture? And it's either on your back, or it's what Mother Nature has for you.
Those are great, great tips to remember. What if, and I know you, like you said, we can what if this to death, with injuries and encounters with different wildlife or whatever, but what if you are just, you know, enjoying the outdoors and you just plain get lost? What are the first few things that you need to do to ensure that you are found?
Right, right. Well, I've never been lost. I've just been, what's the mountain man say? He says, I've never been lost. I've just been mighty confused for a couple months. Yeah, you know, getting lost, people get lost all the time. And you know, they shouldn't get lost. I mean, especially in the lower 48, because we've got, you know, roads and logging roads and all kinds of stuff everywhere. And the key with this is, and I want to talk about this real quick before I answer your question. The key with this is, if you're going hiking somewhere, for goodness sake, take out a map before you go and look at where you're going and figure out what it is an emergency heading to a well-traveled road if anything goes bad. Because there's always an emergency heading to a well-traveled road if anything goes bad. There's just roads everywhere anymore. So if I'm going to go hiking somewhere, if I'm going to go cross-country skiing or snowshoeing or whatever it might be, I know where I parked my car. I also know where the major roads are because I look at the map and I say, okay, now anywhere in here that I'm hiking or snowshoeing or whatever, if I get disoriented, if I take this compass heading, no matter where I'm at, I'm going to hit a well-traveled road. And you know what? You're never going to be lost if you do that in advance. But let's say that you haven't done that, and let's say you don't know how to use a map and compass, or worse yet, you never learn how to use a map and compass, but you have a GPS with you, and the batteries go dead, and you don't know how to use a map and compass because you never learn. So, which that story happens all the time, by the way. So the key with that is, it goes right back to what I say with kids. If you're lost, you're lost. You don't know where you are, so stop wandering around and looking for your way out. You know, and you got to meet your needs. So your clothing and shelter play a big role, protecting you from the wind and the moisture, keeping you either warm or keeping you cool. You got to get some type of signal out. If that means blowing a whistle every 5 minutes, or using a signal mirror to scan the horizon every 5 minutes, or if that means staying next to your car because your car is a great signal. And then you got to make sure you stay hydrated. And then, of course, you got to keep the faith. If you're lost, you're not going to – the worst thing in the world is to start trying to find your way out. There's exceptions to this. There are exceptions to this. And, you know, let's say, for example, the Uruguayan rugby team, that their plane crashed in the Andes, and they sat there for 61 days before they finally said, nobody's coming. And, you know, two guys headed out. It took them 11 days to find help and get the rest of the people rescued. But if they had never hit the trail and walked out, not knowing which way to go, those people would have all perished. So there's exceptions to it. But for as a general rule, you're better off to stop and stay put and meet your needs, signal for help, and keep the faith.
We've covered a lot of what ifs tonight. We talked about, you know, animal bites and broken limbs and getting lost. What are the situations that you see families or hikers get in over and over again that can be mitigated by just a little extra knowledge?
Well, it's all a prior preparation issue. What I see more often than not is I see families going on a trail, you know, and they'll come out of their car and they'll start hiking on the trail, and they've got on shorts in an area that's just covered with poison oak. They're not carrying any water with them at all. You know, their child's already upset and crying before they hit the trail. So, you know, they haven't prepared to keep their child hydrated. The child has no gear on them, isn't carrying a whistle. You know, they don't understand what risks there are on that trail. So the thing I see more often than not is people don't do research on where they're hiking, what the indigenous threats are to the area, and they don't prepare themselves to meet their basic needs, you know, which are, you know, personal protection. We got to regulate our body heat, which are hydration. We got to keep ourselves hydrated, and we need to have the ability to signal if anything goes bad. So it's all about that preparation issue, understanding where we're going, carrying the right kind of gear, to make the trip much more comfortable and enjoyable and safe.
So this is something that's probably more of an opinion, and I know that when we always, as road school moms, we all have our different opinions of how old one has to be or their kids to let them walk around the campground by themselves or, you know, go on a bike by themselves without parental supervision. What age do you think it's safe for kids to hike on their own?
Ooh, that's a good question. You know, have you read the news recently?
Yes, I'm crazy about that. That's why I'm asking.
That is just unbelievable. I mean, I'm just floored by that, to be honest with you. And I think most of your listeners probably know what we're talking about. But nevertheless, that's a tough question because there's such different variances in maturity level in this area. And what I mean by that is we have some families who just do not introduce their child to the safety issues and concerns of the outdoors. So because of the variance of maturity, it's a very tough question to answer. I mean, I don't think you can put an age on it as much as you can an exposure on it. So, you know, it's all about how much have we exposed them to? Have we tested them? Because we need to test them. I'm a firm believer. You tell them about it. You show them how to do it. You let them practice, and then you test them on it. And so for me and my kids, I do repeated tests on various things in regards to what I would expect them to know before I would let them go free on their own. You know, and one of those would be, you know, so this probably puts them a little bit older, but you know, than you might expect. But one of those is going to be that I want them to be able to understand what an emergency compass heading is, and that they know how to trek out if anything goes bad. The other one is I want them to know when it's time to just sit down and start blowing that whistle. So I'm going to do a lot of testing on that. Now, so I'm putting these kids close to 11, 12, 13 before I'm thinking about it. And at that age, I'm going to be testing them extensively. Some kids aren't ready until they're 14 or 15, you know, my thoughts of wilderness and yours might be totally different too. So, you know, I'm thinking, you know, pretty much, you know, very, you know, harsh outdoor is what I'm talking about for my kids. But it's an exposure issue. It's got to be an exposure issue. It can't be an age issue.
Well, this has just been a fascinating conversation with you. I love the way that you've presented how we need to meet our needs and what we can do and what we need to put in our pack. It's just been really eye-opening to me. This is a recording that I'm going to be hitting play on several times. In fact, right now I've been trying to transcribe, but I think that our listeners would be really served if we transcribe this entire edition, because it's just not having that much experience in the great outdoors from a professional standpoint and just enjoying it as is. You know, you're describing my family when you say to get out of the car, they're wearing shorts and flip-flops. One kid's crying already. That's me. That's my family.
Right. Well, I've seen rattlesnake bites on flip-flops.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, if
yikes.
You know, if you're hiking in rattlesnake country, I don't recommend flip-flops.
But this has just been so wonderful. How can our listeners get more information about you and your books and learn from you?
Well, I don't know. You know, they could always go to gregdavenport.com. And by all means, if they're interested in any of my books, they can find them either on, you know, Barnes & Noble or Amazon or places like that. You know, they can always email me at gjd@gregdavenport.com. I'm a very open book. I'm actually very approachable. So I'd be more than happy to answer anybody's questions and help. I'm at the point in my life right now where I just want people to, you know, experience the outdoors, and it's a lost thing. We're losing it with our kids, and it's really unfortunate. They spend more time on the computer and the internet, they're just losing what a great adventure is. And I'd love to see that. So if people have questions, I'd be more than happy to be there and answer them.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for that very generous offer. We will be sure to put your contact information and your website in the post about this. And thanks so much for taking the time to join us and educate us on exploring the great outdoors safely.
Hey, right on. I'm really impressed with what you all do. It's pretty neat. Keep it up. How exciting.
Thanks, Greg.
Yep. Right. Thank you. It's been great having you with us.
Oh, boy. Maribess, I have never thought of things in that way. I feel so much more prepared. Just having that checklist.
It does. He makes it sound so easy. You know, he just kind of flows out of his mouth that he's, so experienced at it. But it really does make you stop and think that if you do have those lists or you do, you know, just like the map thing. I mean, I think I'm pretty prepared on things I do. I mean, you know me. You know how crazy I am before I do anything. I'm always, you know, research crazy. You know, you're the Google queen. I'm research crazy. And I had never really thought about, you know, getting a map out and looking for well-traveled roads. That seems kind of common sense, but it's something that I'd never thought about.
The other thing that struck me during the interview was everything that he mentioned that kids need in their pack is in, drumroll please, the Road Trip Explorers pack.
I have to tell you, I really was patting myself on the back just a teeny tiny bit at the beginning. I'll tell you that was one thing that I was adamant about having, was some sort of a whistle. And when I, you know, of course, you know, just like with everything I do at Road Trip Teacher, my kiddos are my, you know, R&D crew, and nobody was excited about the regular whistle. They just weren't, you know, and we wanted something, you know, at the beginning I thought I was going to try to have something molded that was Road Trip Teacher logo whistle, and then I just happened to find those compass whistles, and I love those because it goes around their neck. You know, just like a, you know, necklace kind of a thing, a lanyard, and it's got that compass on there. And so it's something that we've practiced with, you know, at least knowing whether you're walking north, south, east, or west, that if you do get lost, you know what direction to go back. And the whistle thing, even though it's highly annoying at the beginning when you first get your Road Trip Teacher backpack, you know, that's the first thing they want to do is whistle all that thing, you know, to death through your RV, and you're just like, stop whistling. But it really is a good thing to have.
Yeah, seriously. I hadn't even given, you know, my kids enjoy the pack, so they have no problem wearing it. But now hearing Greg and coupling that information that we learned tonight with what's in that pack makes me feel so much ahead of the game. Now I know what to do with those tools. I just feel like, wow, this is really great. Not only did Maribess supply the tools in these Road Trip Teacher packs, but now I know what to do with them. And we're going to have all sorts of exercises going on with how to read the compass in our house and how to read a map, although we do a lot of map reading because, as you know, full-time reviewers, we do a lot of driving, and I love to sit with maps on my lap while we're driving and show the kids this is where we are right now, this is where we came from, this is where we're going, and this is how you read a map. So we already work on those skills, but coupling that with the compass and then using that map before our hikes is all going to be a grand new adventure for us. So I'm just so excited we did the show. I want to thank Clementine Backstein for suggesting it. A lot of other wonderful moms suggested a lot of other great shows, and we, Maribess and I, are working to get those on our editorial calendar. So this has just been really exciting for me.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, it's funny because I really think, I mean, we were never a real outdoorsy family before we went on the road. I mean, we enjoyed the outdoors, and we'd done things outdoors, and we were definitely a sports-oriented family, you know, about baseball, football, all that kind of stuff. But we didn't hike all that much, and we didn't do, you know, anything extreme at all. And that's one thing that has really grown. The more we've traveled, that's the more things that we've done. And I can tell you that if you sit down and ask any of my kiddos, you know, about favorite memories, or, you know, aside from places that we've met up with friends, or, you know, or family along the road, it always goes back to some sort of hiking out, you know, or adventure or whatever. And we were just talking about this week when my dad was here, and they were talking about the hike we went up Mount Lemmon. We were in Tucson, and the hike that we did at Seguro National Park, and another hike that we did, we were at Mammoth Cave, and, you know, just, you know, a lot of our favorite memories over the last, you know, 2 or 3 years really have came from hikes and outdoor adventures. So definitely something that we like to build on.
Absolutely. Well, we'll be doing some hiking this week because, as I mentioned with Greg and you, we're in Vegas, and we're right outside one of our favorite hiking spots, which is Red Rock State Park. It's this red gash in the earth that you can see from the strip. It's amazing, and there's so many great opportunities to hike there, and you can do as much or as little as you want with your kids. So we'll be putting all of Greg's information to use this week and seeing how that changes our hiking. Like I mentioned, in the past, we have been the most inappropriate hikers on the trail. It's not anything for us to say, oh, look, there's a trail. Let's park the truck and go and be in, you know, Crocs and have, like, one bottle of water between the six of us. And it's just by the grace of God that we haven't run into any issues. But now I feel way more prepared and way more knowledgeable about how to really enjoy the great outdoors. I want to talk about what's going on this week. What's going on this week at Roadtrip Teacher?
Well, we're going to have a little bit of a rerun for us because, as I told you earlier in the show, we got a little sidetracked this week with our unexpected visit, but we're thankful for that. And so we are going to go back and do our kind of our literature-themed week that we were going to do last week. We're going to do that this week with a kind of a workshop, and we're going to act out some of the kids' books that we've been reading. And, yeah, we're just going to kind of go back down that road. We don't really have any formal plans, just going to kind of try to pick up where we left off last week because we've kind of had a week off.
We are going to be preparing for the rally, which is in 10 days, the Las Vegas Back to Basics Boondocking Rally, which is sold out. Kicked off in 10 days on the 25th. We're really excited about that. So me and the kids always have some pre-rally running around to do. And then they are going to be embarking on, mentioned in the beginning about the ebb and flow of our road school. This for the next couple of months, we're going to be doing what you do, Mary Beth, which is time for learning. And we're going, each of my kids has their own device, and so I'm going to be setting them up on the Time for Learning system and see how that goes for us for a little while, because it's been getting old what we do. We do the same thing every week, and there's really no spark there. They just do it because they have to. So I'm really excited to see if Time for Learning hits the mark for them and they get all excited about it. We're also working on the pages up. We're starting to take reservations for the not back to school road school rally in September in Branson. Mary Beth and I are thrilled to be hosting this jointly. And if you want to get in on it, go ahead and go. You can go to fulltimefamilies.com, and under the rallies tab, you'll see it. It's sitting there waiting for you, and we've already had people signing up. So very exciting.
It is very exciting. I can't wait. Our first road school rally that we have was back in Tucson in April of 2014, so this will be our second annual event, and I am so excited. We had so many people that participated in that first one, and I can only imagine all the fun things that we'll have in celebrating our not going back to school.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to not going back to school, too. next week on the show, let me check our calendar here, we have, how to tell your family and friends you're hitting the road. Mary Beth, when you told your family that you were going to live in a camper full time and travel the country, what'd they do? They say, good, go for it?
No, nope. To be 110% honest, as you know, we are, I'm still fighting that battle. We still fight that on both sides of my family. We fight it with many of our friends back home, even though they are, you know, I have a lot of great supportive friends and family, but I also have some that are not so much, and it's a struggle for us still. I'm not going to elaborate on it too much because we'll just save that for next week.
That's right. And you'll hear how my family took the news and whether they have learned to accept it or are still fighting like Mary Beth's family. So if you have any tips or information or stories to share, I invite you to join us. It's Mary Beth and I next week talking about how your family and friends feel about you hitting the road, and specifically how to tell them, when to tell them, and what to tell them. And then on March 29th, the following Sunday, we have special guest Helen Conroy, who is the executive director of the Thinking Moms Revolution. That's an organization dedicated to autism awareness, and she is going to be discussing autism on the road with us. So that's two great shows back to back. I hope you'll join us wherever in the world you are on Sunday night.
Well, that sounds like a great lineup for the rest of March. I can't believe we're already looking towards the end of March, and we'll be into the 1st of April. Gosh, spring is here. It is here, and I don't know. Lots of good things coming up. We'll be so excited when we get here next week to hear about the Boondocking Rally, which will just be right around the corner by then. And if nothing else, then I guess we will wish you all a great week. And safe travels. Come back and join us next Sunday night, same time, same place, right here on the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network, 9 p.m. Eastern. And until then, God bless.
This is Kimberly.
And this is Mary Beth, your Road School Moms, on the road where education meets adventure. Until next time, we wish you safe travels and leave you with our traveler's prayer. Lord, be our guide and protector. Let those I encounter be blessed by my words. Let my hands be filled with your work, and may I be filled with your grace and kind words for others. May I be a light unto those around me on the journey ahead. Amen.
Amen. This has been a production of the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network. If you'd like more information, go to roadschoolmoms.com.